I'm really glad after many, many, many podcasts over the last month to be having this kind of conversation, Chris. This is really fun for me because nobody has been digging at this material in the way that you are. So thank you.
Today's show is a conversation I recorded with David Gushee on his new book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. Welcome to What in God's Name? We're talking today with David Gushee, Distinguished Professor of Christian Ethics at Mercer University. His new book is Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. Joining us on the call is a supporter of our work in ministry, Dawn Berry. You too can get exclusive access to future conversations like this by supporting our work on Patreon. That's patreon.com, and then in the search bar, What in God's Name? I'm so excited to have you with us, David and Dawn. I love searching conversations, and I'm really, I'm just grateful that we can spend this time together today. David, it is our practice on One in God's Name to get our listening community grounded in a little of the story of our guests. You are at Mercer University. Tell us a little bit about the journey that led you to be where you are.
Thank you, Chris. Hi, Dawn. Good to be with you today. It's been quite a journey. I grew up in Northern Virginia near Washington. My father worked for the government in energy and environmental policy. I was raised Catholic and didn't really give it a fair chance. My mom dragged the four of us kids to church every Sunday kind of on her own. But I was a spiritually oriented kid, but I left Catholicism behind and eventually staggered into a Southern Baptist church uninvited on a Friday afternoon as a 16-year-old basically saying, hey, I don't really know why I'm here, but I'm looking for something. And Southern Baptists used to know what to do with somebody when they staggered into a church looking for something. And so 4 days later, I was a born-again Southern Baptist convert, and my journey of faith, personal faith for me, really began. So I became a serious Christian right away, and within 6 months, my vocational questions were all clarified. I was to be a pastor. 17 years old, I was clear. I was going to be a pastor. My high school yearbook says, "We'll be a Southern Baptist pastor." Went to the College of William & Mary, majored in religion, did really well. My professors said, "You need to go to Harvard or Yale." And I said, "Well, thanks, but I'm going to go to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, because after all, that's what good Southern Baptists did." In a sense, a major missed opportunity. I don't know what my life could have been if I had taken that other fork in the road, but I stayed with the Baptists. Got ordained in the Baptist ministry at the end of seminary, but also at the end of seminary, I made a major turn in that I went to Union Seminary in New York for a PhD in Christian ethics. It had to do with a supervisor, Glenn Stassen, a very distinguished ethicist himself, who mentored me in the field, helped me to fall in love with this discipline of Christian ethics, and said, "It's time for you to broaden your horizons a little bit." So I went to New York City with my bride, very pregnant bride, and 25 years old, we started life in New York, late 80s. I did a dissertation on Christians who rescued Jews during the Holocaust, which our friend Dawn here has read, which makes her my new best friend. Thank you, Dawn. Graduated in 93. So I had a PhD in Christian ethics. I had this immersive study of the Holocaust and the vast failure of Christians in Nazi Germany and all over Europe. But that small percentage of people who stood up for their neighbors at the risk of their own lives. That was very formative for me, Chris. to understand who I became. So now, with three kids needing a job, the only job available to me was back at Southern Baptist Seminary. But Southern Seminary was now under new ownership, turning very hard right. So I was only able to survive there for 3 years. And then I moved to another Baptist school in West Tennessee that had a little more breathing room. And that was where I kind of built, you might say, the plane really got launched there. I wrote Kingdom Ethics, which co-wrote it with Glenn Stassen, became a major textbook, became a significant figure in the evangelical intellectual world. But I still felt kind of cramped. Whenever I took a position that was not happy for our Republican constituency, I heard about it. I didn't think that being a Christian ethicist required being a Republican, but I learned I was wrong in that environment. So anyway, in 2007, Mercer University here in Georgia, their president came to me and basically said, come be here. We'll give you all the freedom and all the support that you need. And so I've been here for 16 years, and it's been great. And I have been able to think thoughts without worry about losing my job or running afoul of orthodoxy. A major thing that has happened since I've been here is I wrote a book called Changing Our Mind, which called for full LGBTQ inclusion in the church. I could never have written that in the earlier settings I was in. And that kind of got me kicked out of the evangelical world. So I became a post-evangelical Christian ethicist who had a strong ministry in the area of LGBTQ inclusion. And then finally, in this new book, I came around again to the issue of faith and politics, which I had been diving into periodically all through my career, but with this worry that right-wing Christianity in the U.S. and around the world was not only conservative, it had was becoming anti-democratic. And so that's kind of where we land at this point. So I'm a grandfather, father, a baseball fan, and somebody who loves his work very much, even though it's been one conflict and one battle after another, I can tell you that.
Okay, I have to pick up on the baseball. Atlanta Braves?
Yes, I'm a serious Atlanta Braves fan.
Okay, so we'll pivot from that because we're not up here in the Northeast.
Are you a Boston Red Sox fan?
I am. I don't know about Don, but yes, indeed. We love the Red Sox.
Uh-huh.
But let me ask you this, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it is somewhat connected to defending democracy from its Christian enemies. And I was just listening to you tell the story of your journey, and the phrase you used about your experience of what was happening at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary was, you used the phrase that it turned hard right. So when I hear the phrase hard right, I'm thinking political categories. And you've lived, I mean, in other parts of your story are being an academician and what you could write and not write. You use some political terminologies about that. And I'm always fascinated by that. I mean, fascinated by that because for two reasons. One is, It certainly conveys something, like we understand what you mean when you say they took a hard right. But, and here's the question, do we need to use that political terminology to understand theological stances? And maybe we do, or could we use other language? Does that question make sense?
It does, yeah. Well, it's a very illuminating question because it gives me the chance to say that what was happening at Southern Seminary in 1993 is organically related to what's happening in our politics right now and the religious dimension of that. By turning hard right, it did mean theologically. It meant a narrowing, more conservative theological vision and ethical vision. For example, a school that had been inclusive of women on the faculty and training women pastors, decided that that was no longer going to be okay. That's a kind of a right turn, a resurgence of a patriarchal vision. A school where a variety of perspectives, say, on abortion rights had been there, now you had to be anti-abortion, really, especially in ethics. A school where you would have had a significant mix of Democrats, independents, and Republicans now was essentially riding into its dogma, right-wing politics. And even just the kinds of speakers who would be invited to speak or the kinds of books that we were supposed to be assigning. But also, the people who were the architects of the conservative takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention were some of the same people who were engineering the Republican marriage to evangelicals. And the idea of creating a solid, especially white Southern Christian base of support for the Republican Party. And so you're going to redefine morality to be about homosexuality and abortion and patriarchy. We're against abortion, we're against homosexuality, we're for patriarchy. And that is simultaneously a religious vision and a political one.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. What I heard you say is that the word fusion came to mind. Like there's a fusion of the political with the theological, not necessarily a unity, but a fusion enough that the political language then is appropriate or does make sense.
It does. The fusion is. I've often thought of that word. Sometimes I'll talk about the marriage between the Christian right and the Republican Party. I would say identity fusion is a more provocative way of saying it. If you're a conservative white Christian in the South where I live, you just are a Republican. And there is no gap. That also helps to explain how the Republicans could put forward anybody and the evangelicals are going to vote for them, no matter who. Now, there was a little trouble when it was Romney because they weren't so sure about Mormons. But there was not enough trouble when it was Donald Trump.
Right. So I do want to turn to your book, and I just want to, but before I do, I just make this observation. I wonder about a fusion on what's called progressive Christianity with Democratic politics, and I do wonder about that.
Yeah, I would say so, and I would just also say, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's quite as fused, but it's close, and it is one of the signal dynamics of our time that it's like the political has been collapsed into the religious, or no, it's more like the religious has been collapsed into the political. And there has also been a left-right polarization that that dominates everything.
Don, go ahead. I do want to. I know you want to get in, and I know you've got something to say on this.
I don't want to belabor the point because I really want to get into the book. But I think biblical theology was very political. I think we have to distinguish between political and partisan. When nice. Theology collapses into republicanism or Democrats, then it's partisan. But the Bible is full of political stuff.
Thank you so much. That I think that's a crucial distinction. I'm so grateful that you raised that.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's turn to your book, David. You don't know this, but the essential question for the project of which What in God's Name is the podcast, our essential question for this program year is, what are the moral foundations of democracy? So your book lands just perfectly for us. And again, your presence is really helpful here. I heard a quote this summer I've repeated it to my at a conference. I've repeated it to myself so many times that I've deluded myself into thinking that I actually thought of this. But I'm going to say, this is the quote: "The moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy are not ensured by the practice of democracy." And to me, that was illuminative. I'm going to say it one more time for our listening community. The moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy are not ensured by the practice of democracy, which suggests that there's a pre-political moral sphere here. I think my observation, we've lost the language to be able to talk about this. We've lost the ability to articulate these moral norms. We don't have the language, therefore we can't have the public conversations. So part of my appreciation of your book, David, is your effort at retrieval of these moral norms necessary for the practice of democracy. And your last three chapters are your effort at the retrieval of these moral dimensions. And I want to mention the three chapters, because I'm sure, David, you've forgotten what they were. No, I'm teasing. The Baptist democratic tradition, the Black Christian democratic tradition, and then the covenantal tradition. And so, question for you is, David, as you reflect on what you've written in those three chapters, what are the one or two or three ideas that you think are most important or most promising for us in the United States now to recover the moral dimensions of democratic practice?
I am so glad that that's where you want to start, because I do think that, I mean, and that quote is absolutely right. And I think this question goes back to the very foundations of democracy in the West. You look at Locke and his understanding of the social contract and maybe Hobbes before him. The question, if a government does not belong to the monarch, but it belongs to the people, and the people create a government, what are they creating that government for? What is their vision? And is it really just that we want the government to protect us from one another's violence and thievery? Do we want the government to do more than that? And it has been pretty clear that to sustain a democratic culture requires a certain kind of populace with a certain set of values and practices and norms. But that we've lost that language altogether. It's not in the public conversation. So also, I think, because many conservative Christians in the U.S. and around the world fear that there is a moral vacuum at the heart of culture, they are becoming attracted to authoritarian right-wing politics and politicians who say, I will fill that moral vacuum by decreeing essentially what those values are going to be. So I do think that is not the solution, and that Christians have for 400 years offered rich theological and ethical language that helped to create the democracy that we're now in the process of being at risk of losing. And so in those last three chapters, I talk, for example, about the idea of covenant, that a political community is perhaps best understood as a covenantal community, that is, people who make a compact, a sacred compact with each other, to care about the well-being of the community as a whole, and to behave in such a way as to advance the well-being of the community as a whole. And actually, this covenantal language came from the Puritans, who brought it to New England, and it got into the political vocabulary of the U.S. but we've had to modify it because they had a more of a theocratic covenantalism, and the covenantalism I'm talking about is genuinely democratic and inclusive. But it's the idea that when I leave my house in the morning and I go out and I drive and I go places, I have a relationship to the people that I encounter. They are in community with me, and I am in community with them. And my covenant with them is to act in such a way as to advance their well-being and the well-being of the community as a whole. And so the reason I should care about, say, public education is because my covenant extends to caring about the well-being of every child in the community. And the reason I should care about a healthy social safety net is because I feel covenantally bound to try to create a community in which nobody dies of starvation. And the reason I want universal health care is because I care about living in a community where everybody has the chance to have a decent long life without dying of a preventable disease. So I would like to argue that the language of covenant is a resource that could be retrieved. It's not completely absent, but it's very thin right now. And then when I talk about the Baptist tradition of democratic congregationalism, I think that's a resource because, you know, the birth of the democracy coming out of the British political context was before there was John Locke, there were the Baptists and the Puritans and the Quakers and others saying, we need religious liberty. We're tired of being burned at the stake for having the wrong beliefs. And we need limits on the power of the monarch, and if we need them, other people need them too. And I also say that in any community where you practice democracy, you're getting trained in the practices of democracy. So if you're in a congregation of 100 people and everybody has a voice and a vote, and you deliberate about stuff and you vote and people agree, okay, this is what we're going to do, and then you stay in the community even if you lose. And you don't kill the people who voted against you. In other words, that's democracy. One place Christians learned how to practice democracy was in church. And then the chapter on the Black Christian democratic tradition, I basically say, nobody understands better the flaws of our democracy than African Americans. And the heroic and diligent effort to make our democracy a real democracy, that there's so much to learn from the dissenting, relentless fight for real democracy that African Americans have waged, often headquartered in their churches. So, rich resources to renew our democracy. The parties don't give us this.
Right.
And TV doesn't give us this. This is grassroots community that gives us this. Does that resonate?
It does. I have a rejoinder to what I was thinking when you were talking about the covenantal community. And then Don, I would love to give you an opportunity if you have a rejoinder for David on this. But my reflection was, you know, if we talk about a covenantal community that has its roots in a certain kind of religious way of organizing people, and it's a moral vision of our obligations one to another, the upshot of this is that what you're outlining is a conservative project. It's looking to the riches of the past and making them available for the present and the future.
I would say it is a religious contribution that I am commending to contemporary American public conversation. And it is conservative in the sense that it is attempting to conserve a tradition that seems to be eroding. Just let me give you an example. When a new president is inaugurated, she or he takes an oath of office, hand on a Bible, another hand raised, I do solemnly swear, what is it? To preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, right? That is a covenant. It's a constitutional covenantalism. And it's not just supposed to be a ritual. It's actually supposed to mean that the president understands herself or himself to be in a covenant relationship to the Constitution and to the American people. They're not, and you think about a covenant is it goes beyond rules. A covenant is not just, I will not break the law. A covenant is, I will seek to, I will seek to fulfill the obligations of my office in keeping with the spirit of the covenant that helped to create this country in the first place. You know, one thing I said, I don't want to be partisan. I'm not being partisan. I'm being human, I guess. One thing I thought about immediately when Donald Trump was elected president was, because I was thinking already in covenantal terms at that point, here is a person who has shown no reliability in the area of covenant throughout his entire life. Breaking contracts with vendors, breaking covenants with spouses, constantly breaking covenants. Why should we think that a person who has never seems to have kept much of a covenant would now be able to be interested in keeping covenant with the American people? I think that vision needs recovery. And, you know, actually, our senator here, Raphael Warnock, I've noticed recently, he's using the language of covenant renewal in some of his public declarations. And I mentioned that Martin Luther King used the language of, we need a new democratic covenant during his lifetime. So it's, notice that's the Black church traditions talking right there.
Yeah, this reminds me of, I'm reading Jeffrey Stout, Democracy and Tradition, where Stout is asserting that democracy is just not a bunch of random practices. It's just not a procedure. It's its own moral tradition.
Yes, I totally agree.
Don, did you want to have a shot at this?
I don't really think I have anything to add. Other than when I think of covenant, it requires an investment in community,
yeah,
not in individualism.
Right.
Yes, and I think that this is the problem if the only wellspring of the democratic tradition that we have is something libertarian. I agree to give up some of my liberty to entrust some of that to the state so that I can be protected from harm. In other words, you know, the Lockean type project. And now the libertarianism it remains with us, especially in economic libertarianism. Individuals and businesses should be free to maximize their liberty and profit, et cetera, et cetera. And then also an emphasis on rights. I have my rights, and what the government exists to do is to protect my rights. In a covenantal vision, rights and responsibilities are connected. And you wake up in the morning asking about responsibilities, not just about rights. And so that's especially obvious with those who hold power. Like school principals may have rights, but they mainly have responsibilities. And so do police officers, and so do presidents, and so do defense secretaries, and so do military commanders. When you think about anybody who's in a position of authority, they have responsibilities that are covenantal. I think about, we've been hearing about General Mark Milley, and he's been doing interviews related to what it was like to be the head of the Joint Chiefs in the presidency of Trump. And I read a long interview with him in The Atlantic that just came out recently. And his interview, he exudes a covenantal vision. The covenant, you might say, of what the military is in the United States system. And the non-involvement in domestic politics, and the restraint, and even the character qualities of a military leader are essential to their covenantal responsibilities. So, the military actually is one part of the society where there still is something like a covenantal vision.
Okay, this is brilliant and really really interesting because. Linking rights and responsibilities, I think, is such an important idea. I want to spend a little more time on this. And the rampant libertarian ethos of our culture is so much about rights, 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 to have those disconnected from responsibilities. I'm going to try to articulate this, but Jean Bethke Elshtain, who is a thinker I deeply admire, she talks about the need for authority, like true authority is bound. It's bound to a higher moral law. It's bound to a constitution. It's bound to the judgment of God. You're talking about Milley and his sense of responsibility reminds me of this idea of being bound. Another way to say it is recognizing the responsibility piece of it. And Elshtain's argument is that true authority is bound, and when that binding, that responsibility is forgotten, then you get authoritarianism, because because in authoritarianism, there's no legitimate exercise of power. It's just power for the sake of power without responsibility.
Right. I remember reading, somebody was analyzing Trump, and they were saying, no, I think maybe it was about Milley, but the idea was, you do not know how to be a good general if you do not know how to be a good private. Because when you're a private, you are under authority at every level. Everybody else is above you, and you have to learn how to obey and to submit to authority. When you're a general, you are at the top of the hierarchy, but you're never, this is not authority unbound, because you're bound by federal law, you're bound by military law, you're bound by the Constitution, you're bound by the covenant of your particular role in society. Authority unbound, you might say that the brilliance of the rule of law is that everybody's authority is under a higher authority, which is the authority of the law. And the law itself is under a higher authority, which is the authority of the Constitution itself. So no law can be passed that does not pass constitutional muster. And nobody who exercises authority does so apart from the review of the law and the Constitution. And so authoritarians arrogate all authority to themselves. I am the law. I am in charge. It's the father who beats his children, and they say, "Dad, why?" I am in charge here. Because I'm in charge. You are not to question me. I say in the book that democracy is the rule of the people under the rule of law. It's both. In authoritarianism, if you have law, it's law by decree. And you don't have rule of the people, because you have rule of the dictator or the unfettered sovereign. And human beings who are given that much power, as we have seen, are absolutely dangerous. I think we took our democracy for granted, and we assumed that that everybody who was in a significant position of authority just basically understood these things.
Right.
And I don't think we can assume that anymore.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. This is getting us towards your opportunity to talk about authoritarian, reactionary Christianity. But before we get there, I wanted to ask you this. The definition of democracy in your book as the rule of the people under the rule of law. Can there be the rule of law if there is something that you mentioned earlier in our conversation, which is a moral vacuum at the heart of polity at the heart of our society. I'll just leave the question there. I mean, I could say more about that, but I guess I am going to say more about it. Hold on. Hold on before you respond. I mean, I'm having in mind a kind of a natural law perspective, right? That human law is somehow then in its own way bound to natural law, moral law. I mean, even the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, he appeals to natural law in some of his rhetoric about how blacks are treated in our country. So the question, can we have the rule of law if there's this moral vacuum?
I'm really glad after many, many, many podcasts over the last month to be having this kind of conversation, Chris. This is really fun for me because nobody has been digging at this material in the way that you are. So thank you. Your question is, I think there's two different things going on there. I mean, one is the rule of law. I think it's one of the oldest insights about law. And that is that if you have an unruly, undisciplined, immoral population, you could never have enough enforcers of law to have the rule of law actually functioning. In other words, if there's a moral vacuum in society and everybody is just doing whatever they can get away with on a given day, then the rule of law cannot function. So you need to have people who most of the time, most days, are self-regulating. They don't need a police officer on the corner to make them behave. And, you know, one of the oldest arguments for a Christian role in democracy, even in or monarchy or theocracy, is that if you do not constantly, if the highest powers in the society do not constantly reinforce a stern moral code, then it will erode, and it will become anarchic and chaotic. And I understand that argument. I do think that the state enforcing that religion or moral code has proven to be problematic, except for the basics of the moral code that must be enshrined in the law itself. But somebody in culture, families, non-governmental organizations, schools, religious communities need to be training people's character so that they do not need to have a police officer on every corner. I actually explore the natural law question in the book because to me it's really complicated in this way. It is true that a risk with popular sovereignty or majority rule is that the populace will, by majority vote, enshrine immorality in the law, like segregation. And Martin Luther King borrowed from Aquinas to say an unjust law is no law at all. He borrowed natural law theology to ground civil disobedience. The laws we are breaking are not really laws because they are enshrinements of prejudice. And so we're going to break these laws, cheerfully go to jail for doing so in the effort to get the laws changed so that they will conform with morality, with the natural law. The problem, I end up concluding in my chapter on this, that the people will not be likely to recognize the legitimacy of a law if it does not conform with widely agreed transcendent principles. Whether to call that natural law, I'm not sure about. And the other thing is, especially like on the issue of homosexuality, natural law arguments are used against the recognition of same-sex relationships because they are deemed to be violations of the natural law. So what exactly qualifies as in keeping with nature or in line with the natural law? Who decides that? I remember seeing in my presence, I think I may have said this in the book, I don't remember, a bitter argument between a South African jurist who was gay and a Catholic natural law theorist, the one saying same-sex marriage is in keeping with what is just and right, and the other saying same-sex marriage is a absurdity because it violates natural law. They almost came to blows, it seemed, that day because their concepts of the natural and how law should relate to the natural were irreconcilable. So I'm not an expert on natural law, but I do think I understand why MLK made a natural law type argument to ground the civil rights civil disobedience argument. And I do think that arbitrary exercises of legislative or judicial power violate a built-in moral sensibility. And if we want to call that natural law, then that's what it is. You might call it, I think Paul said, the law of God written on the heart, right? There is some sense. If the legislators were to say, we're going to kill, you know, everybody over the age of 90 because they are a drain on public resources, the vast majority of people would say, no, that's not okay. So there's something there. But a lot of times the use of natural law in contemporary legal, moral, political conversation is a kind of a right-wing Catholic project as much as anything, and it doesn't resonate with me.
I have to say I have a certain sympathy for natural law talk, partly because I was trained by Jesuits. So let's pivot. There's so much more to like. We could go down this path for a while, but let's pivot towards. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about the phrase that you use in your book. We've talked about remedies for the illness, if we want to use that metaphor. You know, the moral norms embedded in some of our traditions that we could retrieve. And now let's go back to what is the problem? And you identify the problem as authoritarian reactionary Christianity, and you don't use the phrase Christian nationalism, which is the usual phrase in public discourse at this point. So I puzzled about this for a little while, David, and I just want to ask you, tell you what my reflections and see if I'm on the right track. I think you did this because, but I don't know why you did it. I'll just tell you how I react to it. Christian nationalism to me seems like something inert, like a feeling or an attitude or an identity, Christian nationalism. And when I sit with authoritarian reactionary Christianity, the connotation is something a lot more dynamic, that there's movement to it. It's energized by reaction, and its response, its remedy is authoritarianism. So that's how I have parsed it for myself, the difference between Christian nationalism and why you use this authoritarian reactionary Christianity. Tell us about it, because it's a key piece in your book.
I really like how you experience that. It is what I was going for, energized by reaction. It's a dynamic thing. It's a visceral thing. It's not just we prefer to live in a traditionalist Christian nation where, you know, John Wayne is president and the men are in charge and the gays are back in their corner and women are know that they're, you know, in other words, it's not just a preference. It's not even just a vision of a Christian nation or a godly republic or something. It is a ferociously negative reaction to cultural and political and legal changes in the U.S., and this is happening in other countries too. And I argue in the book that you can see this from the beginning of the modern world, but most relevant for our purposes, since the 1960s. And if you live in the South, I know you don't, but I do, you can throw a rock and you'll hit somebody. You're not supposed to throw rocks and hit people, but if one were to happen to do that and you were to say, how do you feel about what's happened in this country since 1962? You would be very likely to run into somebody who say, it's all been awful. It's been a rebellion against God, a rebellion against God's law and God's will. Take your down-the-line reactionary. They took prayer out of schools. Women abandoned their families. Sexual morality went to hell. Perversion was blessed. And then if they're going to be racist too, they forced integration on us. They diluted our predominantly white society with a bunch of immigrants from other places. People gave up on patriotism and began protesting against their government all the time. Vietnam War. We lost respect for the flag, for the military, for the country. So, in other words, there is a significant minority. It's not a majority of the American public, but there's a significant minority who believes that the whole story of America since about 1962 is a story of moral decline and religious abandonment of God and God's law. And democracy has failed for some of these folks. They would say democracy has failed because democracy has blessed all of this decadence. The laws have changed to do things like allow abortion and to allow gay marriage. And no matter what we do, no matter how much we organize politically, we can't seem to get these changes reversed. So maybe democracy is not our answer. Maybe we need authoritarianism. So I'm saying reaction is the jet fuel. It is rocket fuel. And authoritarianism becomes a tempting solution when every other strategy has failed.
Don, would you like to get in?
So, yeah, I'm really curious about the date, 1962, because isn't it 1964? The Voting Rights Act. It seems like a lot of this reaction also stems from civil rights, from the challenge to white supremacy. And I might say also white supremacist patriarchy.
Yeah. I put it all in there, a great big stew of resentment. And the advocates for reaction will target different things, right? They might say that the ultimate outrage was Roe v. Wade, okay? Or they might say it was the 1962 Supreme Court decision, I forget the name of it, that said that the schools cannot sponsor Christian prayer. A public school cannot sponsor Christian prayer. I think that was 62, that's why I picked that year. Certainly the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Acts of 64 and 65 and the whole civil rights movement freaked out large parts of the country, especially the South, the white South. But don't forget, 1965, there was a new immigration law that allowed a lot of immigration from the global South. And so America became less Euro-American and more global, with a lot of people from non-European countries immigrating here. And the feminist movement, I am continually struck by how salient patriarchy versus feminism is in our current discussions, even today. And the gay rights movement came along a little bit later, but, you know, Stonewall and gay pride parades and then, of course, gay marriage. You know, I think this 2015 gay marriage decision should not be underestimated as fueling the forces of reaction. I also think the election of Barack Obama twice is a major fuel of the force of reaction for a certain population. And so you add it all up. And now what the Christian right used to say was, it's the moral decline of America that we're against. And we're for family values. And they tried to bracket off race because racism was delegitimized as a cause. But I do think that racial reaction is all over this story. It's not everybody, but it's a significant chunk of reaction. And so to your original question, Chris, the sociologists Andrew Whitehead and Sam Perry, who revivified the language of Christian nationalism in their book "Taking America Back for God," I bless their hypothesis in this way. When people say we want to make America Christian again and we want to have a Christian nation, and then they fill that with this content, it's white-led, it's native-led, it's male-led, it's conservative values, it's Christianity enshrined in power again. In a sense, that is the goal. You might call it a utopian goal of a reversal of every social change since about 1962. But to me, by talking about reaction, I think I identify the jet fuel, you might say, and then authoritarianism is most relevant to the anti-democratic part of it. Because you can strive for a Christian nation through democratic means. But some of the folks, the people who were in the Capitol on January 6th, if they were Christian nationalists, well, whatever, but they were trying to overturn the results of an election, and that's a different kettle of fish when we're talking about democracy itself.
So we're going to need to stop here in a second, but I just thought of this. I wanted to ask this. This project of protecting democracy from its Christian enemies, and I'll continue the military metaphor. Isn't it a two-front battle? So, in other words, of course, there's what we just commonly refer to as the religious right. But there is an illiberal left, and a piece of that illiberal left is what Rowan Williams calls the programmatic secularists, which is as a program, as an ideology, religion needs to be privatized and marginalized and just kept out of any kind of public conversation. And what I love about this project and what you've written about is it's you talk about yourself as a mediator, and I think this is a place of mediation, which is to say no to that programmatic secularist perspective and no to this authoritarian rightist Christian authoritarianism, and yes to a recovery of a moral vision, some moral language that's really based on the roots of our religious practice. Is this fair?
I am loving this conversation, Chris, because you get me. And it's always nice to be understood. I am definitely not a programmatic secularist. And the people who, I mean, I was on a podcast earlier this week, and, you know, in the chat, people were just like bashing Christianity. You know, we just need to banish Christianity, just, you know, whatever. The problem is religion. If we could just get rid of religion, everything would be good. That's not my project. It's a slice of the American religious population, and there are plenty of other ways of being religious that are covenant, you know, covenant oriented, or that are more inclusive or justice oriented or whatever. So the problem is not religion. The problem is reactionary religion. Non-inclusive religion. Religion that understands that's about dominance and marginalizing those who don't agree, don't share our version of a moral code. So no, it's not a programmatic secularism, and I actually think that religious voices of the type that I'm attempting to articulate are essential in our public square right now. I would say essential to keep us from totally flying apart as a society into just complete incomprehension of one another. Programmatic secularism versus authoritarian reactionary Christianity is a recipe for civil war. But there's lots of us, millions in the middle, who are faithful church-going or synagogue-going or mosque-going believers who are who have a vision for the common good that is neither of those other visions.
Right.
And I also look in the public square for politicians who are able to be in that space too, who speak a robust, values-rich language, who talk about the way religion positively informs their vision, but who are not authoritarian, reactionary Christians.
Thanks. Don, we're wrapping up, but I do want to give you a chance if you wanted to ask another question or just simply make a comment.
No, I think I just want to thank you for this space and for this conversation. And you really helped me, I guess, reframe. I like the idea, authoritarian, reactionary Christianity. But I'll also say it's tough to be a mediator.
Yeah, right. It is indeed, especially when we're so tribal, my team versus their team. You know, did you notice that I talked about in the intellectual history the way that, like, mediating Catholic voices in the 1960s and 1970s helped the church, the Catholic Church, move off of its reactionary posture and come to a pro-democratic posture, like in the Vatican II documents, you know? Mediating voices that understand and live with the concerns of the right, but have not gone to the radical left, are essential, I think. And yes, I think you need mediating voices intellectually and culturally, and it is really hard to be such a voice. I hope. Now, a lot of my enemies on my right would say I lost being a mediating voice a long time ago. I'm just a liberal. But I think, Chris, you understand from reading this book, and Dawn, that is not the kind of book I've written here. And I have named the illiberalism of the left as a problem.
Yeah.
I'm more concerned in the Christian community about the illiberalism of the right, because that's what we're seeing in the Christian community. But there is an illiberalism of the left, too. And the more radical and illiberal both sides get, the more it feels like a winner-take-all, no-rules-apply kind of fight to the finish. And that is a recipe for disaster.
David, is there anything else you want to add at this point as we wrap up?
I would just say that, the 2024 election cycle is upon us. And, if we used to argue about parties or we used to argue about policies, right now we're arguing about democracy itself. And if you're arguing about whether you're going to have a democracy, that's an emergency. And that's where I think we are. And I hope this book informs the conversation and can help pull us back from the brink of trading our democracy away for something that was rejected 400 years ago and rejected in our country in 1776 and 1789. So I hope to be clear about what the stakes are, and maybe my book can help with that.
We've been talking with David Gushee. His new book, Defending Democracy from Its Christian Enemies. We'll have a link in the show notes where you can pick up this very fine book. David, wow, what a great pleasure. Don, great pleasure to be with you and to have this conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was an honor to talk with you, and I've truly enjoyed this conversation.
If you like what you've heard today, and you like what the What in God's Name Project is doing, please consider sponsoring our work for less than $1 a week on Patreon. It's barely any money for you, but it means a lot to us, and so we thank you.